Welcome to Trep Talks. My name is Sushant. I am an e-commerce entrepreneur, and each week we bring an inspiring entrepreneur or business person from e-commerce, retail, or tech industries to help you discover how to start and grow your own e-commerce business. Thanks for spending some time with me today, and let's get started. Hey there, entrepreneurs. My name is Sushant, and welcome to Trep Talks. This is the show where I interview successful e-commerce entrepreneurs, business executives, and thought leaders, and ask them questions about their business story, and also dive deep into some of the strategies and tactics that they have used to start and grow their businesses. And today, I'm really excited to welcome Aaron Spivak to the show. Aaron is the co-founder of Hush Blankets. Hush Blankets create weighted blankets that help people to reduce stress and fall asleep faster. And today I want to ask Aaron a few questions about his entrepreneurial story and some of the strategies and tactics that he has used to grow his business. So thank you so much for joining us today at Trep Talks, Aaron.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I know you have started businesses in the past. So I'm really curious to know if you could share a little bit about your entrepreneurial journey and how did you get the idea for Hush Blankets?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I was always an entrepreneur, naturally, I would say I'd had the bug when I was such a young kid, from selling hats that my mom used to knit in grade school to I used to have a window cleaning company where we would knock on doors in the neighborhood, and me and friends would clean people's windows. And in high school, I started a party bus company, which I actually ended up selling at the end of high school. And at one point, we were doing about 900 proms a year, facilitating all the buses, getting people to and from prom and all that. So I always had a knack for really taking care of a need, or at least a need that I thought people had. And it was very fun. It was exciting. It was great to be, that person taking care of an issue for people. And for the hats, people wanted custom hats. And for the window cleaning, people had dirty windows and they didn't want to pay, large companies. And for the party buses, principals and board members were always concerned of drinking on the bus. So I knew if I could provide a safe and reliable solution, people would jump on that, and I can get board members and principals on board to help support me. And then also, who doesn't want to support a student at the school, right? So I always kind of had that thing. And then in 1 year out of high school, when I was 18, along with my brothers and my mom, we started cold press juicing in my mom's living room. And the core behind that was we wanted to have a healthy alternative. I was an athlete. I played hockey my whole life. So we always were looking for ways to advance our health and our well-being. And we did that through juicing and through eating healthy and through healthy alternatives. And now, at least in Toronto, 7 years later, there's a bunch of vegan and healthy options all around the city. But 7-8 years ago when we started, there was really nothing. So people used to come and knock on my door at 8 o'clock at night and be like, hey, can we get some juice? And we'd sell them right out of our house. And fast forward a year, we saved up our money and invested into opening up our first location, and transform 6-7 years down the road. We have 10 locations now, and we have an e-commerce store and all that. And then a few years ago, my partner and I, we were just friends at the time. Have both had our own businesses, and he kind of approached me and said, I was spending some time volunteering at a camp for children with special needs, and they had a room they called the stimulation room. And it's a room that has all kinds of different stimulation devices for whenever, kids want to relax or sleep or for whatever reason. And he said, I'd always found myself in this room, and I was constantly gravitating towards this heavy pad. And it was like the best thing to sleep under. And then we did some research, and we found that there was a Kickstarter that one guy ran, which was a very similar product. And we were so mad because there was just no real weighted blanket that would fit on my bed and be comfortable and wouldn't sound like a rain stick at night and was easily washable. Like, we just wanted our current duvet to be heavy. We wanted all the beautiful luxuries of our current duvet, but we wanted it to be weighted. And we said, maybe we can come up with one. Maybe we can make one. So we spent all of 2017 developing our product, and then we launched 2018 with just three SKUs. And Fortunate enough, within a few months, we were able to completely sell out before we even got our inventory. And then that's kind of where it started. And we've been fortunate enough to come out with new SKUs and develop and from there. But it really all started from when I was a little kid.
And was that the entrepreneurial bug, was that encouraged in your family? Like, were your parents entrepreneurs themselves, or was that something innate that you as a person had in yourself?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think both. I think both. I mean, I've four brothers, there's five boys in my family, and we're all so different. But my mother was a natural entrepreneur. She immigrated from Israel to Canada with three children in her 20s. She had no English whatsoever. She's still not that great in English. And she started her own agency, and took her years to get her feet wet. I would say at least 10 or 12 years till she finally got a business going. And she built a really good business for a bunch of time before that ended. And she was, growing up, I got to watch her do this. So as a kid, that whole monkey see, monkey do might have a play in that, and I always admired that. And I guess that's, you can see that's where I got it from.
Can you share a little bit about what the blanket and weighted blanket industry looks like in North America? I'm assuming that blanket is such a generic product, there would be a lot of competitors. Was that the case with weighted blankets also? And what was your value add that you brought with this company that you created?
Yeah, I mean, the sleep space in general in North America is growing. I think it's about a $6 billion industry, and it only grows every year. But that's sleep. When we started, we were just focusing on people who suffer from anxiety and insomnia, and then surrounding issues like ADD, ADHD, and light saturation and stuff like that. Kids on the autism spectrum, and that was our main focus, because we were more problem solution based. In terms of competitors, yeah, we've got a tremendous amount of competitors. We've got every manufacturer in China is selling on Amazon. We've got 5 to 7 local players in the Canadian market, and we got 50 to 60 players in the U.S. market. However, I think when we first started, there was only about 3 or 4, and it's grown since, and it's actually been great. Competition has been an amazing thing, because when we first started, there wasn't much parity in the market. It was, there was one or two options to choose from, and if one offered a sale and the other one did it, then people would go to the one that had a sale, and it would go back and forth. But now there's great parity, and people are actually able to see the difference in quality, right? There's blankets out there for $40, right? And shipping on our product is over $40. So we're definitely the premium. We spend a lot of money on R&D. We went above and beyond. I would never sell a product that I wouldn't use myself. And that was a big thing. And I know even with the juices, with the party buses, I was one of the best buses. I was one of the best blankets. We want a blanket that actually works. We're not interested in just, making a sale and hooray. And, you may or may not get a return, but if that customer has a sour taste in their mouth, like as if they spent too much money and got a subpar product, that didn't sit well with me. I mean, I want people to feel like they got more bang for their buck. So, we try to price ourselves competitively, but when people feel our product and touch it, it really is a game-changing product. So in terms of differentiation between the product, we have 45 different SKUs. Most people are running with like a twin or a king option, where, we have got SKUs from 5 pounds all the way to 35 pounds, 5, 10, 8, 12, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35. We've got ranges from king to queen to twin to teen to kids. We've got throws. So we really are the staple. If you are looking for a solution for your sleep, and you think a weighted blanket is a space, people will come to an option. We've got warmer ones and cooler ones where you can choose exactly the one that fits your style, your bed, your weight, and your decor. Actually, we have different colors as well.
So that's very interesting. So let's say that if I'm trying to buy your blanket, how would I know which weight to go and buy? Is there like a criteria that a certain blanket would work better for me as opposed to someone else?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we recommend that people select a blanket that is around 10% of your overall body weight. And then in situations where there's two people sleeping in a bed, we ask you to add up your total weight and then do 10% of that. So for example, if there's a king bed and there's two people sleeping and the average weight is 300 pounds, for example, or like around 300 pounds, then you'll get a king and 30 pound blanket. Because there's just, you know, there's weight that's not on you. There's weight on off to the side. And then if you're getting a more personal size, like a twin, and you know, you're anywhere between, you know, 112 and 140, 150, then you'll get a 15 pound, anything above you'll get 20. And if you're, you know, over 225, then you'll get the 25 pound. So yeah, we always recommend to get something within that 10% range of your weight.
Okay. And initially was there, an idea validation process? So to me, it seems like you started out with this idea in the mind that, you know, this heavy weight blanket can be used for therapeutic purposes for certain therapeutic niches. But now it seems like it's become more of a consumer product. So was there like an idea validation process where you realized that, you know, it's not just good for a therapy product, it can be more used as like a consumer, mass consumer product?
100%. That was our goal from the beginning. We didn't want to just be super problem solution based. We believe that majority of us are not unlocking our sleep potential. We're not really getting the quality of sleep that we need. Many of us are sleeping between 5 and 6 hours. We have constant light saturation. Or depends on where you live, you might have underlight saturation. We're not really taking advantage of our 45 to 1 hour of REM sleep. A lot of us are anxious, especially now with Corona and COVID and all these things going on. There's so many reasons that keep you up at night. So for us, it's not necessarily about, oh, you have a problem, we have a solution. It's about, do you feel like you can improve your sleep? And, you know, we sleep between 25 and 35% of our entire lives, and to not take that part of our life seriously, but to take everything else part of our life seriously is, you know, just not the smartest thing to do, right? We have, you know, we don't even eat 30% of our lives, for most of us at least, right? We don't eat 30% of our lives, right? So, you know, there's almost nothing that we do other than sleep and be awake that is 33% of our lives or more. So we don't even work, depending on what your workload is. And if you actually look at the amount of time in your life that you're working, you don't even work 33% of your life. So it's so rare to actually have something that carries so much weight in our life, yet so many of us are sleeping with, you know, toxic foam mattresses that are layered with glue, down pillows that absorb bacteria, non-organic sheets that are made with all different types of dyes, and the same thing with our duvets. If you sleep with a down duvet, the way that, so like there's so many things that we just it's not even our fault. They're just, no one has ever actually went about educating everyone. The bedroom was always about decor for so long, not functionality and not science. So being able to educate people on that and kind of seeing that transition over time has been amazing. We to see the reviews, to say the way people have changed their lives. We've had people who say they haven't slept in 7 years. They haven't slept more than a single hour in 7 years, achieve like 4 or 5 hour sleeps, which is groundbreaking when we look about the reproductive cycle. And, you know, our immune system only heals itself at night. Mm-hmm. So there's just so much about it that we're happy that our product can, you know, play a part. And, you know, the Hush blanket isn't going to rewire your entire world, but it'll definitely, you know, give you one step forward in the right direction.
So now when you look at your sales data or analytics, are you able to say that there is like one or two big segment that is your main customer?
You mean like our demographic?
Yeah.
I mean, I find like that demographics usually are attributed to your source of traffic. Okay. So, in terms of source of traffic, we're on, you know, the Facebook, Instagram, which is kind of the same. Google and YouTube is our main source of the traffic. So, generally we have Facebook, which is a 35 plus platform for the most part. Then we have Instagram, which is about 18 to 35 and up. And then we have YouTube, which is pretty much anyone. And Google, which is search intent, which again is around 35 plus for us. So our demo is generally 25 to 55 for the most part. But we have been trending younger, which is showing signs that we are in the better your sleep phase. So our education is getting across, which is great. But yeah, that's really our demo.
So YouTube is the YouTube ads or organic and ads both?
Sorry, say that again?
When you said YouTube, is that YouTube ads, the traffic coming from ad? Do you run ads on YouTube?
Yeah, totally. We okay. Run we run ads. We run ads on YouTube.
So I know that so you started this business with a co-founder, a friend of yours. I'm very curious to know how does the, you know, can you share a little bit about the story of when you came together? Like maybe your co-founder pitched this idea to you. How do you talk about equity division and what kind of legalities are involved in terms of, you know, actually setting that up as a business?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. I was just having a conversation with another friend who's about to start a business with his friend. And I think the most important thing when it comes to starting a business, and if you're starting with a friend, I mean, I have business with family, I have business with friend, I've done both. I learned a lot in both of them. And the biggest thing is to have the hard conversations right away, like right in the beginning, because if it goes the way you plan it to go, which is like, you know, straight up, that's our plan. Our plan is to even up, but eventually be trending upwards, more ups than downs. Then you're going to be faced with realities of each of your lives, right? And if you're different in age, if you're 10 years apart, and let's say you're 25 and your partner is 35 and your partner is married and you're yet to be married, there's so many different things you have to take into account. And not that it's not going to work out, but if you don't have those conversations up front, like, hey, what happens when you know, what happens if you get divorced?
Yeah.
You know, what happened? And you know, those things, you don't want to have those conversations because it's like, I'm never going to get divorced, but it's okay. But it's over 51% chance that you do. So let's at least plan it, right? We can change it, but let's talk through what happens in the situation. Let's talk through a situation where we make $1 million in profit 1 year, and let's run through a scenario. What would you do? What would I do? Right? Because what's going to happen is when we reach different points in our lives, we have different priorities. So today, starting your business, you and your partner have the same priority for the business to be successful. But in 5 years from now, your partner might have the priority of wanting to maintain a lifestyle, right? Maybe not push so much, right? Maybe he's comfortable. Maybe let's just maintain and grow slowly. But you, on the other hand, don't care to maintain so slowly, and you want to put the money back into the business and keep growing. And that can cause a whole boatload of problems, and then you've got to buy each other out, and there's just so much involved. And even if it's friends, I mean, my partner's, you know, one of my best friends. But you know, we set in stone, we had a hard meeting right in the beginning, and we said, what's going to happen if this happens? We're not married, but what's going to happen when you do get married? What's going to happen if you do have children? What's going to happen if we get an offer for someone, you know, someone puts an offer sheet and wants to buy you out, and one of your partners says yes, and one of your partners says no? These are huge problems. That can be avoided right in the beginning, and can be avoided with putting the emotional excitement of starting a business away for a moment. Because if you're an entrepreneur, you're always excited, like you start spending all this time and stuff, right? Put that all aside and have a real conversation and say, you know, who is going to be the CEO? What exactly are you going to do? What exactly am I going to do in this business, and how exactly are we going to grow this? And it never goes to your plan, but as long as you're constantly on the same page from the beginning, you'll be able to, it's kind of like a marriage. You'll be able to pick your partner up when he's down and or she's down, and the other way around. But as long as we understand that the business is more important than the personal, then at least for me, that's been, you know, I've had a few incorporations and none of them have split up or anything like that. So for me, that's what's been working.
And I guess it's probably a little bit easier when you're trying to work with someone you already have some history with, rather than, you know, if you just met someone 2 months ago and then you're trying to start a company with them. Or it doesn't matter as long as you have those conversations and you get all the legal stuff done right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So you don't think it makes any difference?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it can. It's just, I guess the underlying message is to make a list of every possible worst thing that could happen. I know it's very negative, and when you start a business, you want to be super positive. And it's exciting, and there's momentum, and there's so much around it. But just take one day out of all the excitement and say, let's make a list of everything the worst that can happen. And let's put it together right now what we would do. And then you can go back and change it. You know, in a year, you guys most, but let's revisit that list. Maybe we'll act a little differently. You know, let's revisit that. But it's important right in the beginning to set it up in a way where you have kind of like a code of conduct that you both can trust. And that's the most important thing, you want to trust. And you can trust that to fall back on when things, you know, go one way or another, right? When your return on ad spend falls through the roof and one partner wants to keep it going because you want the customer and the other one wants to stop it because he wants the profit. All those things you have to take into account.
So can you take us through the first few months of your business when you had the idea and you were working on the prototype? Did you have to put, given that you already have both had your own businesses, did you put certain financing, your personal money in the business to build those first prototypes? And what was that whole process like?
Yeah. So, you know, I've always bootstrapped my businesses. I don't have the great fortune of coming from, you know, a rich family where I can just get a loan or some sort of gift or whatever. I've always had to kind of save up and put all my eggs in that basket. You know, when we started the juice business, we juiced out of the house for a whole year, saving up the money to then open up a store, which we still fell short on. But, and same with Hush. With Hush, I was, you know, I saved up my money from the juice business for 3 years and put it all into Hush. And same with my partner, he had a software business. He saved up all of his money to put it all into Hush. And sometimes, I mean, some people can't stomach that, right? And that's one of the benefits of starting a business when you're younger, because, you know, if you have a wife and kids and a mortgage, taking all your money and throwing it on a business idea is probably not the smartest thing to do. But I was in my 20s, I had my only liabilities were rent and a car, which can both be eliminated. I had the opportunity to fail. So yeah, it was completely bootstrapped. We put everything we had into it, really, both times.
And how did you get your prototypes created? Like, did you hire a company to create the initial product, or what was that process like?
So I pretty much bought every single competitor or similar product out on the market that was available, and I basically picked them apart, cut them open, sliced them up, sent fabric samples out to some labs out in the US, which is really cheap. They'll tell you exactly what the decomposition is. And I really studied my competition and went on their support channels, and I messaged them and I asked them difficult questions. And I really gathered as much information as possible to see what makes them, what are their holes? What are the holes in their product? What are the holes in their business? And I did that across the board to who I thought were my biggest competitors. And then I set out to build a product that was just as good, but it didn't have any of the holes, and it was significantly better right out the gate. So yeah, I mean, in terms of R&D, we did that, and then we found a supplier who was willing to support us in producing that. Right, a lot of times when you're creating a product, your supplier is going to have high MOQs when you're customizing a product, and that's very expensive, right? So finding that relationship where you have a supplier who believes in your product and that you can not have huge MOQs that really put you in a bind to start, right?
And this whole research process and building the prototype, was this like a period of weeks or months? How much
time? It took us a full year, actually. Took us a full year. And our trick was, we were buying like $15,000 worth of competitors' products. It was quite expensive, but for the most part, a lot of them had really good return policies. So we'd bring it in for like 30 days. We'd learn everything about it, and then we'd ship it back. We kept doing that over and over again. We'd recycle our money. And then by the end of it, we actually ended up keeping everything. And I've got a storage locker right now with every single one of my competitors' blankets in it. Really understanding, we use glass beads, glass sand, they're micro beads, they're glass the size of sand. And the reason I even got to that was because cutting open a competitor's blanket, I noticed that they're using plastic poly pellets, which are essentially toxic pellets. They're very, very cheap to make, but they're big and they sound like marbles when you move at night, and then overall they're toxic. They're not healthy to sleep with. So if it wasn't for that, doing that research phase, I wouldn't have known to develop the glass, which is completely clean, safe, environmentally safe, and because they're so small, they don't make any noise when you move.
So after you had this product, which was better than any of the competitor products out there, when you launched, what was that first year like for you in terms of marketing and sales, and how did you get your first sales in that first year?
Yeah, I mean, when we launched, there was one thing we didn't want to do. We did not want to drop ship anything, because no offense to drop shippers, but drop shipping is about making money. Let's just call it what it is. You're drop shipping because you want to flip a dollar for two. That's it. Yeah. We both had working businesses. We weren't interested in just earning money, because we can just keep doing what we're doing. We're earning money. We were interested in building a brand that people would recognize and would trust when it comes to improving their sleep. And the only way to do that was to bring in inventory and to show people through marketing and through our brand that this product is the solution to what they're looking for. So our main channel right off the bat was Google. We wanted to target people who were specifically searching for a need and for a product that we offered a solution for. And then we matched that up with just some simple retargeting on Facebook. And we were able to actually make a couple sales in our first day. And it hasn't quite stopped since then, really.
And were you given that your product was kind of unique, were you able to get some initial press? And did that, if yes, did that help at all?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, when we launched our Kickstarter out in 2019, it was the first time that we really went after press. It was really hard. I don't know, maybe I just suck at PR, but it was hard. It was tough to get press. We were sending hundreds of emails a day and different types of press releases and split testing email headers. And it was tough. And we did. We got really good press. We were in all the top magazines and all that. We ended up being successful at it, but I don't think press was a main needle mover for us whatsoever.
Okay, so I want to ask a couple of questions about your appearance on Dragon's Den. Could you share, from your perspective, what was the rationale behind going on Dragon's Den? Because I think at that point your sales were pretty good, so I think you already had money. Was it more of a strategic decision to say, these dragons, these business people can help you get into retail or the different channels? What was the reason for going to Dragon's Den?
That's a great question, and it's a great assumption, actually. It's almost dead on. So Dragon's Den was something we didn't give as much thought to as it seems. it was a spontaneous, I follow one of the dragons on Instagram. They had a swipe up to submit an application to audition. I just swiped up, filled it out, got an email a few weeks later saying there's the first level of auditions is coming up in a few weeks. And I was like, you know, Lior, hey, let's give this a go. And we went and we were unprepared. We didn't bring the proper materials. We didn't have a pitch. We didn't know what we were doing. We fully botched it. We didn't think we'd make it to the second level. And then a few weeks later, we got a call. We said, hey, you want to come to the second level? And then at that point, we took it very seriously. We started treating it like it was supposed to be treated. We did a ton of research on every single one of the dragons. We spoke to hundreds of people who pitched them before. We hired a pitch specialist. Like, we went, if you see the pitch, I mean, it was rated the best pitch of the season for a reason. And we were extremely strategic in the way we spoke to them. We have this give back program where we donate a ton. We had a huge emphasis on that. And our goal, honestly, was to speak to the people watching. We weren't so interested in, well, that's not necessarily true, but we were more interested in speaking to the 35,000 people watching you live rather than the four or six dragons, you know, watching in front of you. So we went in with it and said, okay, there is six dragons in front of us, very important, very powerful people, will and can help us in our future. But there's 35,000 other people right behind them who may actually be able to help us right away and support us and become customers of the business. And that was our goal. And you know, if you watch the pitch, and if you have or you haven't, you'll see the way that it moves you and the way you feel. And that was our goal. Our goal was to leverage the way that you're going to feel just watching it.
And one of the things that I also felt, and, you know, I want to know your opinion, is that maybe the reason that dragons were so interested in your business was because, number one, it was already profitable and it was growing. And number two, they could probably see that both of the co-founders had a entrepreneurial history and, you know, they were kind of like a proven entrepreneur. So that kind of takes away risk for anyone who's investing in it. Do you think that part of partly helped in your success on the show?
I don't think so. I mean, they didn't know anything about us. It was the first, when we walked into the den, it was the first time they saw our faces. They had no idea who we were. And we didn't, we were there for 40 minutes.
They don't know anything about the business beforehand?
They know nothing. Yeah. It's okay. The first time they're hearing about us. So they don't know too much about us. They ask a lot of questions. I mean, we're there for almost an hour and they only show 5 minutes, right? So we do get deep. We do talk a lot. And, yeah, I think what they loved about us was how different we were and how we didn't only have like a regular duvet and we had the iced and we have multiple options. So I think there was a lot of levers around it and it was an emotional pitch. It was an emotional pitch. We really left our heart out on the table and we feel that they felt that, right? They felt that in there and they responded, you know, great. We were very happy with the response.
Yeah, and one question I want to ask about is the valuation of your company. Of course, the valuation of any company, it depends on, you know, what the investor is willing to, you know, say that your company is worth. But when you asked for the certain amount of money for a certain percentage of your company, could you share, you know, what was your rationale behind coming up for that valuation? And do you think that you undervalued your company because everyone wanted to pay you more for your company than what you had valued it for?
Yeah, I mean, first time in 14 years of that show did an evaluation increase on television. So that, I mean, did we undervalue? Yeah, we did. We did undervalue the business. Was it strategic? No, I don't think it was strategic. I think we were just a little bit nervous that we would come in at such a high number and they would immediately be like, whoa, no chance, go home kind of thing.
And your valuation strategy was, you know, to see that what our revenue number was last year and just say that, you know, 5x to 8x of that number, or how did you come up with that number?
Yeah, that's a good question. It was really hard to come up with that number. It wasn't simple. We called all kinds of people. We didn't necessarily have enough data to draw a real evaluation. We had a full year and 4 months. So, you know, we had a really good 4 months. We just came off, you know, that episode was shot right after our Kickstarter campaign. So it was a really good 4 months, but we had no real data to show that there's any real growth year. We haven't even had a year over year at that time. So for us, what we did is we rounded off what 2019 was going to be, and then we times it by two, which is what we did, a 2x revenue model. Ended up being way off, so but that was what we did at the time. We asked a few people, it seemed to have made sense, and then yeah, we kind of just we took that number and we actually reduced it by I think half a million or a million, just because we didn't want to come off as overpriced on the show. And yeah, that's what it was.
So what happens after the show? So you got the deal. I'm sure there was some due diligence process, some legal you know, agreement signing and things like that. What is it like working with these business people? What kind of support do they provide you after the deal is done?
Yeah, so basically on the show, the deal is like it's a handshake deal. It's not real in a sense. There is due diligence that you do after the show, and they get these people, your accountants, and they negotiate. And the deal actually dragged, the negotiations dragged on all the way until the episode actually aired. And when the episode aired, we actually earned in that time frame more than what we were going to get from the Dragons. Hmm. So it became less about the money and more about what we can, you know, how we can work together and how we can get how can it be a mutually beneficial business for both of us. But from their perspective, which, you know, we totally agree with, it was two people splitting, you know, 4% each. It's not so much you're gonna go out of your way and do for 4% of a business, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you're parting ways with $400,000, right? So we actually mutually decided that it wasn't necessarily worth anyone's time. For us, it wasn't worth. We didn't necessarily have an immediate need or use for the money. And for them, they didn't necessarily have anything that they were willing to put on the table as an immediate value add for our business. So it was kind of a transaction that over time, although it was amazing on the den, but as time went on, became, you know, as hindsight became 2020, wasn't necessarily worth it for either of us. So, you know, we still keep in touch with them here and there. I mean, they're incredible people. Really, they've done just by being on the show and the way they reacted has done a lot for our business. So it was a great experience. Really, I learned a lot.
Okay, that's very interesting. Very briefly, I wanted to ask you about your the Kickstarter campaign that you ran, and that was also very successful. What can you share? What was the reason for it its success? The campaign.
Yeah, what was the reason? It's a good question.
Like, did you run a very good marketing campaign for the for your Kickstarter campaign?
Yeah, I mean, we basically launched in 2019 on the back of one of the worst summer ever in 2018, and we went from making. And when we first started, I think like 10 or 15 sales a day. And then in the summer, we're making like zero or one.
Okay.
And it was just awful. It was actually the point where we were going to close the business down and say, this is just not worth any of our time. And I was like, you know what, let's send out a survey to all of our customers and let's ask them why they would not buy the blanket in the summer. And all of them responded saying, it's just, we need a cooling option. We need a cooler option. We need a cooler option. So Lear, and you know, coming back to your first question about setting things up with your partner, we set something in stone that we're not going to, if this business is a seasonal business, we're out. We want no intention of being part of a seasonal business. Yes, there's going to be, you know, there's going to be busier seasons, but we want to be able to sell 12 months a year, not only in the winter. So we went and we developed the cooler option. And the way we did that was actually binding different fabrics together. And when we successfully did that, in order to get that done, you need to order a large amount of fabric from the mill in order to get your price to where it needs to be. And we didn't have the capital, or we weren't really that willing to spend that much money on a product we haven't even sold one of. Mm-hmm. So where else better to go when you have a prototype of a really cool product but not enough money to produce? Kickstarter. So we dumped all our money into that campaign, everything we made over the last year, and we said we're going to have either a successful Kickstarter or we're not going to have a business anymore. It's one or the other. And we set up, the video we shot in LA, we knew there was a need for the product. Weighted blankets have done historically pretty well on Kickstarter. We know there's never been a cooling option. We know that every person that's ever bought a weighted blanket on Kickstarter is in the same as our customer, wants a cooling option. So we made one that was compatible with all the previous weighted blankets that were sold. So, we launched, and we had a lot of our own customers, and we did a lot of lead gen, and you know, it turned out to be for a Canadian campaign. It was it turned to be the top 10 of all time most raised. So it was a great campaign.
That's pretty good. So what are all the channels that you are in right now? So you're in e-commerce. I believe you're selling on Amazon, and you're also selling retail now?
Yeah, we actually haven't been on Amazon. If you see us on Amazon, it's probably just a reseller trying to make some money, which is fine. And we just got reinstated actually yesterday, funny enough. We were banned from Amazon for 8 months for something we didn't do. One of our resellers, which is why you probably saw us, tried to trademark our name. And you can't trademark a name you don't have, right? So they thought that we were him and he was us. So they kept him alive and they banned us because they thought we were the fake. So it took us a while. I mean, obviously we have a trademark, so we had to send documents and Amazon's very slow. So 8 months later, we just got reinstated yesterday, which is amazing news. So we will be on Amazon. We sell on hushblankets.ca, hushblankets.com, .com services, the UK and the EU and all of the US, and then .ca services all of Canada. We don't sell in Australia just yet, or like Singapore or anywhere in Asia or the Middle East. That's pretty much it. And then there's we sell to retailers. We have a wholesale division, we have a wholesale team, and they sell to over 450 different retail shops across Canada and the US. So we're in a bunch of locations there.
So I'm assuming your retail business is much larger than your e-commerce, or is that not?
No, definitely not. Retail is about 5% of our overall business.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, we have two full-time, we have a director of sales and a head of sales that work together hand in hand. And, they're both incredible people and great gentlemen that do a really good job for us. And they've single-handedly grown our wholesale department from, you know, being really a fraction of a percent of our business to, now 5%, which is pretty significant growth for them.
Okay. One thing, because your product is so heavy, can you share a little bit about your fulfillment? Is it that you charge the customer for the shipping or
no, we don't actually. We offer free shipping.
Okay.
We're worldwide, depends where you are, but pretty much North American wide free shipping. When we first started, we used FBA as our fulfillment center. So you can do multi-channel fulfillment and just fulfill from your e-commerce store to them. But customers would complain that they would get a box with Amazon, but they didn't even order it from Amazon. So we then shifted to a 3PL and was a horrible experience. We used them for our Kickstarter and they lost us a tremendous amount of money, a tremendous amount of product. They missed orders to the wrong people. It was just a mess. And it was so bad that we actually went and we invested into our own warehouse. So we developed a 25,000 square foot warehouse of our own. We built an office on top. And, we house all of our inventory in one place. We ship nationally from one spot. And it's been incredible. We've actually been able to beat FBA shipping times for the most part. So it's been, you place an order, it gets fulfilled within, depending on the time of day, it can get fulfilled within seconds. So quite amazing.
I want to talk a little bit about the marketing. I know you mentioned previously a little bit about, you did Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Google Ads. One thing that I found very interesting, I think I read somewhere, is that you're doing SMS marketing. So can you talk a little bit about, in terms of effectiveness of marketing, like getting new customers in the pipeline, which channels work really well for you and how effective is SMS marketing and what was the reason behind that?
Well, you definitely follow me on LinkedIn, so that's awesome. SMS is something we took very seriously, I would say October of 2019, last year. Email rates are dropping. Email open rates are dropping. It is what it is. Everyone's getting emails all day, every day from everyone. And it's really hard to maintain a engaged audience via email. So we know one thing for sure. We know that SMS, if it gets through, it's 100% open. Everybody opens up their text at some point throughout the day. It's, we don't necessarily have great filters like we do on our inbox yet. I mean, eventually once everyone's doing SMS, I think there'll be some filters and rules in place. but right now there's not. So, it's amazing that we can have and build quality relationships through SMS, right? Like I personally will send messages to people and, say, hey, how's your day going? How's the hush? You got it 2 weeks ago. Talk to me about it. How is it? And they'll respond. And it's just from their phone. Like they're texting one of their friends. And how we grow that on our site. Our opt-in now is don't give me your email, give me your number. Let's chat. Let's have a conversation. I was posted on my LinkedIn too. I genuinely care a ton about our customers. Even till today, I'm on the chat so almost every night. Obviously, I can't get to everybody, but I try to answer at least 100 chats every night, and just to chat to people and just see what the overall consensus is. See how people are feeling. What brings you here? Why are you on hushblankets.ca.com right now? What's that problem? What's that solution? First time customer, second time customer. You're in the VIP club. You're not in the VIP club. There's so many things that we can communicate, but I don't need to communicate via email. I don't need to send you a long email. You don't need to send me a long email. It's just a simple text and say, hey, how's it going? Then I can do it for you. Yes. No. Cool. So yeah, SMS is great. I love it. I really love it.
Which SMS marketing platform do you use?
We're using Postscript.
Postscript. Okay. Yeah. Can you share a little bit about your team? And especially I'm interested to know how big is your marketing team, and given, the recent Corona pandemic and everything, how have you been being productive in managing your team? Like what system have you created to manage and make sure everything is working right?
Yeah, obviously we were all in office before the pandemic, so everyone going home. You got to put some new things in place because the culture is different. It's really tough to build culture when you're working from home. But yeah, we're 16 big, our team. And our Google is in-house, our Facebook is in-house, our creative and content team is in-house, our social team is in-house, our affiliate and influencer side of our management is in-house, our wholesale, like I mentioned before, is in-house, our fulfillment is in-house.
Everything Toronto-based?
Yeah, everything is Toronto-based. Our customer service team, we have a few Toronto-based, a few in the U.S., one in Texas, one in Delaware, one in Croatia, and one in India. Our manager is in India, which is amazing, and one in the Philippines.
Okay.
So we do that because we want to. We have a service 20 hours a day, so it's good to have different people in different time zones.
And do you use like some team management softwares and things like that just to keep updated on everything? Or are there like managers who actually are responsible for their team and they report to you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I don't believe in micromanaging. I don't think I hated it as a person. I hate when people try to micromanage me. And I hate micromanaging people. I don't think that people need a babysitter. If they do need a babysitter, then they're probably not right for this specific team. Maybe they go somewhere else where they get micromanaged, you know. Some people love being told exactly what to do every single minute. I don't like telling people what to do, and I don't want to hire people that like being told what to do, you know. So I don't – what we basically use – I mean, it all depends on what you're doing. If you're in the wholesale division, then you don't necessarily have a task manager that you're working with. You are you're simply working with your CRM, and you're working with support to enable the transactions to go through the way you want. So, you know, you bring on a client, you set them up, and then support will help facilitate the transaction, make sure they get their blankets, their products on time, and stuff like that. So, and then we have, you know, elite. They're basically, you know, sourcing and hunting. So they have their own process. Creative will use multiple platforms. They'll use platforms for storage. They'll use platforms for organization. They'll use platforms for task management. So for task management, for example, we'll use Monday.com, which has been great. And we use Monday, and then we'll use certain calendar apps to integrate with that. And we'll use Later and Linktree and all these different types of social platforms to help organize our posts and our structuring. Then we have an overall marketing calendar that we built just on Excel, actually, that our entire team will reference. So our Facebook team will pop on there and see what's going on and prepare. Our creative team will pop on there and make sure it's going to care. Then we have an influencer and affiliate calendar that syncs directly with Monday. So our affiliate manager will update that. So it's there's very little overlap between any of the different divisions within the business. There's very, very little overlap. Lior, my partner, and I will kind of be that overlap. We will be that overlap. We'll step in and we'll connect groups and we'll double check. But we don't do performance reviews every day, or every week, or every month. We're very quarterly. We're checking in. We're helping. If I check in with a group, you know, if I check in with creative, it's not, hey, what are you doing? You know, prove to me that you're worth it or whatever. It's more about, you know, hey, what's cool? What's your problems? How can we help? How can we speed things up? How can we get to where we need to go? And that's really what it is. I mean, we believe we have a very talented team, and for the most part, a lot of them are doing their jobs better than I can do their job. So I'm not here to tell them what to do. I'm just here to support them and, you know, see if I can do anything.
Okay. Finally, what has been, in your opinion, one or two biggest mistakes or failures that have been made in starting and running Hush Blankets? And what have you learned, or what can other entrepreneurs learn from those mistakes?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think biggest mistakes. I wouldn't even necessarily say they were mistakes, I'll be honest. I just didn't have the information that I have now. So I made decisions based on the information that I had. So I would say they were the best decision I could have made at the time.
Okay.
You know, in our first year, 2018, the Christmas season, Black Friday, Cyber Monday, Canada, there's Boxing Day, there's the Last Chance, there's so much going on. But it was our first time really doing ads. So we had an 11x ROAS in our first year. And we were like, this is amazing. You know, like, you know, we're making every dollar we're putting in, we're getting $11 back. Like, we're geniuses. Like, this is the best thing ever. And, you know, little did we know, it was like we were putting $1,000 in and getting like $1,100 back, you know?
Okay.
and literally, like, knowing what I know now, like, it was a mistake, because what we should have done was scale up to, you know, a more reasonable 3 or 4x ROAS and, you know, spend instead of $1,000 a day and make $4,000 back instead of $100 to make $1,100 and acquire those customers. So, but I didn't know that at the time, you know? So at the time, it was the best possible decision I could have made. It was an amazing decision, right? But now looking back, we're able to understand that there's differences, there's different businesses, there's different business mindsets. So I would say, well, that's one of the mistakes. I mean, we made many mistakes with inventory. We sold out, we oversold so many times. I mentioned before, 3PL, you know, we hired a 3PL that overpromised and underdelivered to us. And at the time, they have this big, beautiful office and they work with some of the biggest companies. So at the time, I was like, this is the best decision I could be making. Hired experts, they know exactly what they're doing. But hindsight, it was all a facade. They didn't know nothing. You know, they had no, their systems were fake. You know, they said they had these things and they didn't, and we only found out when it was too late. So I guess if you're listening to this and you're like, how is this going to help me? Because everything I said to you was so particular to me. How is this going to help? It really, like, what I said originally was, like, in terms of, like, when you're setting things in stone, when you're starting your business, that's where it all comes out, right? Like, it all comes out when you're looking at an 11x ROAS and you're spending $100. If in the beginning we set in stone that we're going to scale no matter what, every dollar we make, we're going to put back in, then we would never have made that mistake of accepting this 11 ROAS, because we would have pushed the pace. We would have pushed it to a 4 or 5x or 3x, whatever was profitable at that time, or break even at that time. Right. And the, you know, again, in the beginning, when you set in stone that you're only going to work with people that you can speak to their customers, if you're going to hire agencies where you can call their best customers, ask them how it went, right, then we would have avoided the 3PL, because eventually I spoke to other customers and I'm like, how are you guys surviving with these people? Because I'm like, I'm just joining them, it's a nightmare. And they're like, we've been trying to get out forever. And I'm like, oh my God, I wish I called you before. So if you set it up in a way in the beginning where we're not going to make a decision, an uninformed decision, when the information is out there. I mean, if you're listening to this right now, then you're obviously seeking information. I'm trying to give it to you. So if you're listening, I'm giving it to you, you're receiving it, hopefully you're writing it down. If not, whatever. But in the beginning, if you take that, if you take it seriously and say, these are the things that are non-negotiables. When we write a PO, we're buying insurance. Right, there's typhoons in China right now. There's boats getting blown over. You don't buy insurance, you lose your whole PO. Right, so there's certain things that have to be non-negotiables, and we didn't have those non-negotiables because we didn't know, and there was no one like me on a podcast telling you that you're listening or whoever else is listening to do this. But once you set those non-negotiables, like now, for example. For us to hire an agency, it's like they got to pull every single tooth out of our mouth. It's, you know, as opposed to in the beginning, an agency would call us and say, we can double your business. And we're like, yes, you're hired, double the business, please. Right. And, you know, there now the question is, oh, you're going to double the business. How? Like, show me exactly how you're going to double the business. And oftentimes they show you what you're already doing. And you're like, well, thank you so much. Yep. Right. Appreciate you doing absolutely nothing. So I don't have to waste my time. Right. And sometimes they'll show you a 10-step plan. There's one small thing that there was a nugget in there. They're like, oh my God, I can actually use that. Appreciate that. Thank you. Move on. Right. And sometimes they'll blow your whole cap off and you're like, boom, you're hired. Right. So for us, it's important to set those things in stone. And now after all these, you know, after 2.5 years, it feels like 10, you know, we're planning our whole Q4 launch now. It's in September 1st. And we're planning like all of Black Friday, all of Cyber Monday, all the inventory, the whole thing is being planned now, like this week, as opposed to last year, we planned it 4 days before. So like it was a mess and the thing didn't work. And, you know, like we know how to treat Facebook, for example. You can't just double your spend overnight. not a smart thing to do, right? Facebook sees that as a big red flag. We did that on Black Friday last year and got banned from Facebook for a full 2 days. Only God knows what our potential would have been, right? So little mistakes like that, that all come from our lack of putting things in stone in the beginning, following them, respecting them, allowing them to change, right? Allowing yourself to change and following it. And then also trusting your gut, right? Making whatever you think is the right decision at that time.
That's really great. I know we're running out of time. I want to do a rapid fire round that'll only take 2 minutes. So
cool.
the idea is that I'll ask you a few questions and you have to answer them in one or two words or one or two sentences.
Sure.
The first question is, do you have any book recommendations for entrepreneurs or business executives in 2020 and why? Do you read a lot of books?
I don't read a lot of books, but I definitely read some. When I traveled more, I used to read more. The Culture Code by Dan Coyle is an incredible book if you're trying to build a team, even if you have a team of one, two, three, how to deal with people, what makes people move. And you'll be surprised, as you may or may not already know, it's not always money.
An innovative product or idea in the current e-commerce, retail, or tech landscape that you're excited about?
Oh, I love SMS. I think SMS is so innovative. It's so new. It's so untouched. And yeah, I think that's going to be the biggest needle mover for a lot of brands.
A productivity tool or software or idea that you use to be more productive, or do you recommend?
I use my Google Calendar like it's everything. I schedule every single thing of my day, from waking up to working out to eating to breakfast to showers to lunch to meetings to getting jobs done. I'm like a robot. So my tool is having yourself organized, using your time wisely, and having a really clean cut calendar that you actually follow.
And if you say that, you know, you've scheduled 30 minutes for workout, it's like you are going to do that in that 30 minutes. So you're able to follow every little thing on your calendar.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm wearing a tank top right now. I had to reschedule this by 30 minutes because I forgot that I had my schedule, my workout schedule. And I couldn't not do it because it was dead on in my schedule. So I had to do a shift, and I took 15 minutes off of that and then added 15 minutes to the next one. So, if anyone knows me knows that, like, I won't even answer the phone call if I'm doing something else. I won't even see my phone, actually. Notifications are all off. If I'm, like right now, like, I, who knows? I can be getting 100 calls right now. So everything's off. This is my scheduled time. This is what I'm doing. I'm focused. I'm locked in. And then, boom, I can move on to the next thing next.
A peer entrepreneur or business person who inspires you?
A lot. Right now, he's a good friend of mine, but a guy named Chris Giles. He's semi-retired now, but really look up to a lot of things that he's done in his life and how he lives his life, which is the most important. And actually, my cousin, who's she just turned 46, just had his birthday. So happy birthday to him. And who just, you know, business. Yeah, they're both really good at business, but just the way they live life and the way they carry themselves is something I admire for sure.
Okay. And finally, best business advice that you ever received or you would give to other entrepreneurs?
Best business advice I've ever received was to pay more attention to your customers than your competitors. Because it's very easy to get wrapped up in what your competitors are doing. People who are paying you money are way more important, and you should pay a lot more attention to them.
And those were all the questions that I had, Aaron. Thank you so much for your time. You were very generous with your time. Really, really appreciate that. And now is your time to share your website where people can go and buy your products.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking for a better sleep and you're in Canada, it's hushblankets.ca. For anywhere else in the world, it's hushblankets.com. And if you want to hear more from me, just follow me on LinkedIn. I think it's just Aaron, Aaron Spivak, Spivak. And I try to accept pretty much all connections as much as I can. So if you ever want to get in touch, that's where to find me.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Aaron. Really appreciate you sharing your entrepreneurial story and all the different strategies and tactics that you use to grow your business. So really, really appreciate your time. And thanks for joining us at TripTalks.